At the same time, we also have to know that this is a very old story, and it's a story of how people who fight and die for freedom in great liberation struggles around the world are sold out in these transition periods. You know, there was another news story that came out last week in the run-up to the happy elections. The headline was, U.S. cannot account for $9 billion of Iraq's oil money. Maybe it was a little bit different than that, but basically they lost $9 billion. That's the bottom line. The CPA lost $9 billion, not of their own money, but of Iraq's oil money. And this came out because there's an annual audit. And the auditor said that $9 billion had been paid to appointed Iraqi politicians without providing any receipts or any accounting for where that money went. So as we watch the next few weeks, I mean, we don't know who the next government is. I've never seen elections that people are so excited about the fact of them and so uninterested in who wins. And I think that should be very telling. Never has the U.S. government been so completely uninterested in who wins elections in a country where it is intimately involved. The reason why they don't care is not just because these key decisions have already been locked away, but because so many people have been systematically bought off. You don't lose $9 billion to your appointed politicians by mistake. And that really is why they needed those 2 years. They needed those 2 years to lock in all sides of this, at the IMF, at the legal and constitutional level, but also to bribe people so that they will occupy themselves because it's cheaper. And they can pull back to their bases, which is what they want, and outsource the occupation to their surrogates. That's the place we're at right now. How much time do I have? How many? I think we need to think about this moment in the context of how many past betrayals have taken place in Iraq. How many previous occasions on which freedom has been promised and then been betrayed. Thinking about it in the context of the financial and military support for Saddam Hussein during the Iran-Iraq War, because he was seen as being important to control the spread of Islamic nationalism more than anything else. And also the betrayal in 1991 when the Shias were told by George Bush's father to rise up and topple their dictator and that they would be supported and they were left to be slaughtered. That's when most of the recent mass graves took place in which the Canada was part of that war and the United Nations, and it's not something that can just be pinned on the Bushes. That was the worst betrayal. And then the betrayal of the sanctions, where, yes, everybody knew that Saddam was very well taken care of and that the people who were being systematically targeted, who were suffering, were the poorest of the poor, were once again actually the same people who were told to rise up and were left to be sacrificed. These are the people who had no water infrastructure because it had been bombed and then it wasn't fixed under the sanctions. And then the betrayal of the promise of liberation that turned into brutal occupation. And now these elections, which, as I said, are on the verge of being another great betrayal. But I actually don't believe it has to be that way. I don't believe it has to be that way because these elections, the only reason they took place at all is because of the relentless and courageous demands taking place inside Iraq, that people have risked their lives again and again, taking to the streets and forcing their occupiers to deliver on the promise of democracy and liberation. And they've been dragged kicking and screaming all along. And as I've described, they have finally caved in to the hollowest form of democracy imaginable. That said, there was one good thing that happened, which is the United Nations, when the U.S. appointed the interim government for the June 28th handover, it was supposed to be the June 30th handover, they needed a United Nations Security Council resolution to recognize the new government. And in the original text of the Security Council resolution, they also asked for them to recognize the Constitution as the legitimate law of Iraq. But Sistani intervened, and he said that the Constitution is illegal, it was written under occupation, and it should not be ratified by the UN. And the U.S. was in such a rush to get the Security Council to pass this resolution, because by this point Bush was on the election campaign trail, and he really needed his resolution, and he needed this handover to take place. So they caved, the U.S. caved, and they took out the reference to the Constitution. So what I just described about how they can't change the laws, that Constitution is in place, and they're trying to pass it on to this next government, but it's never been ratified by the United Nations. So if the new government decides that they don't want to be bound by any of these laws, they are absolutely within their rights to do that. And that should be and can be their first act as a sovereign government, to just tear up all of Paul Bremer's economic reforms, all of his laws that he never had a right to write in the first place. Because we know this story. We know it from South Africa, one of the greatest liberation struggles of our time. I was in South Africa a couple of years ago. I went to a meeting in Soweto of the Soweto Electricity Crisis Committee, this incredible direct action group, where when the electricity that's being privatized gets cut off, the struggle electricians who used to work for the electricity company but got laid off go and reconnect the electricity, and they do the same with the water, the struggle plumbers. And what they're saying is the ANC was a democratic movement that was fighting for democratic rights that were about more than just voting. They were about the right to water. They were about the right to housing. They were about the right to work. It was a whole package that understood that voting is just a symbolic part of democracy, and that it's meaningless without the right to dignity and the right to survive. And they are insisting. They're not saying we don't believe in democracy. They're saying we want it all. We want deep democracy. We want what we were promised. And at this meeting, there's an old man who stood up at this meeting of the Soweto Electricity Crisis Committee, and he lost a leg in one of the Soweto uprisings. And he said, you know, I fought for freedom in this country, and now my water's just been cut off. This is not what I fought for. But he is still fighting. And we have seen democracy movements betrayed across Latin America in these transition periods. Finally, Argentina finally freed from the brutal dictators, the generals who disappeared 30,000 people, particularly trade unionists, because it was economic genocide. It was political genocide against the left. Finally freed, and in the transition, the deal is made. You'll inherit the debts of your dictators. They ran up the debt from $6 billion to $46 billion, and the democratic Argentina had to pay the debts of their dictators, who ran up the debt, building concentration camps in which they were disappeared. This is when the deals are made, in these transition periods, when people are so happy that they're going to get a little bit of freedom, that sometimes they don't see how much freedom is actually being negotiated away. What's going on in Iraq isn't happening in the past tense. We're not talking about a past betrayal. It's unfolding in real time. It's unfolding right now. And people are resisting it with everything they have against tremendous, unthinkable military might and winning incredible victories. You know, when I think about that protest in January, last January, I get really sad because I think, where the hell were we? Where the hell were we? You know, 10 million people, or by some accounts, 35 million people marched against the war on the eve of invasion. But when Iraqis marched in their streets and said, we want the democracy and the freedom that we were promised, we should have mirrored that protest in our cities. We should have been there saying, yes, yes, election, no, no, selection. And we should have done it in Washington, we should have done it in Vancouver, we should have done it in Ottawa, we should have done it in London, because they were screaming at their occupiers. We should have done it here. And I believe that if we had, I think that they would have won. And I think that we need to think about how we mirror those demands, the demands for total debt erasure, not to pay for any of the debts of their dictator or of their occupiers, or to be bound by any of the structural adjustment programs that have been illegally negotiated by their occupiers and their surrogates. This is what self-determination means. So I think we have our work cut out for us. I think that this should be the dawn of a new kind of anti-war movement that isn't just about symbolically saying, not in our name, we marched, we were against it. Not about proving ourselves right. You know, this question, was the left wrong about Iraq? Who the hell cares? The issue is, will anything positive happen at this moment? What will we do to support the people in Iraq who don't care whether we were right or we were wrong, but who are fighting right now for their sovereignty, for their self-determination, for their freedom? Will we worry about our anti-war egos and say, well, we think nothing good could ever come of war, so we're not even going to bother supporting them now? We must support them now. That's our duty. And I believe that it's more than our duty. I think it is the blueprint for what our future movements will look like, because it will be a combination of the best of our anti-capitalist analysis with the best of our anti-imperialist analysis, the best of our anti-racist analysis, the best of our anti-war analysis, to create a movement that is genuinely for democracy and self-determination. Thank you.